reactions under control, and to take sides according to what was just. When he found out that Marcello and Michele had confronted Reno one evening, and though they hadn't laid a finger on him, had grossly insulted him, Pasquale had entirely taken Reno's part. When he found out that Silvio Solara, the father of Michele and Marcello, had gone in person to Fernando's renovated shoe store and calmly reproached him for not having brought up his daughter properly, and then, looking around, had observed that the shoemaker could make all the shoes he wanted, and then where would he sell them? He would never find a store that would take them, not to mention that with all that glue around, with all that thread and pitch and wooden forms and soles and heels, it wouldn't take much to start a fire. Pasquale had promised that, if there was a fire at the Cerullo shoe shop, he would go with a few trusted companions and burn down the Solara bar and pastry shop. But he was critical of Lila. He said that she should have run away from home, rather than allow Marcello to go there and court her all those evenings. He said she should have smashed the television with a hammer, and not watched it with anyone who knew that he had bought it only to have her. He said, finally, that she was a girl too intelligent to be truly in love with a hypocritical idiot like Stefano Caracci. On those occasions, I was the only one who did not remain silent, but explicitly disagreed with Pasquale's criticisms. I refuted him, saying things like, "It's not easy to leave home. It's not easy to go against the wishes of the people you love. Nothing is easy. Especially when you criticize her, rather than being angry at your friend Reno. He's the one who got her in that trouble with Marcello. And if Lila hadn't found a way of getting out of it, she would have had to marry Marcello." I concluded by praising Stefano, who of all the boys who had known Lila since she was a child, and loved her, was the only one with the courage to support her and help her. A terrible silence fell, and I was very proud of having countered every criticism of my friend in a tone and language that, among other things, had subdued him. But one night we ended up quarreling unpleasantly. We were all, including Enzo, having a pizza on the Rettifilo, in a place where a margarita and a beer cost 50 lire. This time it was the girls who started. Ada, I think, said she thought Lila was ridiculous, going around always fresh from the hairdresser and in clothes like Princess Soraya, even though she was sprinkling roach poison in front of the house door. We all, some more, some less, laughed. Then, one thing leading to another, Carmela ended up saying outright that Lila had gone with Stefano for the money, to settle her brother and the rest of the family. I was starting my usual official defense when Pasquale interrupted me and said, "That's not the point. The point is that Lina knows where that money comes from." "Now you want to drag in Don Achille and the black market and the trafficking and loan sharking and all the nonsense of before and after the war?" I said. "Yes. And if your friend were here now, she would say I was right." "Stefano is just a shopkeeper who's a good salesman." "And the money he put into the Cerullo's shoe store he got from the grocery?" "Why? What do you think?" "It comes from the gold objects taken from mothers and hidden by Don Achille in the mattress. Lina acts the lady with the blood of all the poor people of this neighborhood. And she is kept. She and her whole family, even before she's married." I was about to answer when Enzo interrupted with his usual detachment. "Excuse me, Pasca. What do you mean by is kept?" As soon as I heard that question, I knew that things would turn ugly. Pasquale turned red, embarrassed. "Keep means keep. Who pays, please, when Lina goes to the hairdresser? When she buys dresses and purses? Who put money into the shoe shop so that the shoe repairman can play at making shoes?" "Are you saying that Lina isn't in love? isn't engaged, won't soon marry Stefano, but has sold herself? We were all quiet. Antonio murmured, No, Enzo, Pasquale doesn't mean that. You know that he loves Lena as we all of us love her. Enzo nodded at him to be quiet. Be quiet, Anto. Let Pasquale answer. Pasquale said grimly, Yes, she sold herself, and she doesn't give a damn about the stink of the money she spends every day. I tried again to have my say at that point, but Enzo touched my arm. Excuse me, Lenu. I want to know what Pasquale calls a girl who sells herself. Here Pasquale had an outburst of violence that we all read in his eyes, and he said what for months he had wanted to say, to shout out to the whole neighborhood, Whore! I call her a whore! Lena has behaved and is behaving like a whore! Enzo got up and said, almost in a whisper, Come outside. Antonio jumped up, restrained Pasquale, who was getting up, and said, Now let's not overdo it, Enzo. Pasquale is only saying something that's not an accusation. It's a criticism that we'd all like to make. Enzo answered, this time aloud, Not me. And he headed toward the door, announcing, I'll wait outside for both of you. We kept Pasquale and Antonio from following him, and nothing happened. They didn't speak for several days. Then everything was as before. 46. I've recounted that quarrel to say how that year passed and what the atmosphere was around Leela's choices, especially among the young men who had secretly or explicitly loved her, desired her, and in all probability, loved and desired her still. As for me, it's hard to say in what tangle of feelings I found myself. I always defended Leela, and I liked doing so. I liked to hear myself speak with the authority of one who is studying difficult subjects. But I also knew that I could have just as well recounted, and willingly, if with some exaggeration, how Leela had really been behind each of Stefano's moves, and I with her, linking step to step, as if it were a mathematics problem, to achieve that result. To settle herself, settle her brother, attempt to realize the plan of the shoe factory, and even get money to repair my glasses if they broke. I passed Fernando's old workshop and felt a vicarious sense of triumph. Leela clearly had made it. The shoemaker's shop, which had never had a sign, now displayed over the door a kind of plaque that said, Cerullo. Fernando, Reno, the three apprentices worked at joining, stitching, hammering, polishing, bent over their benches from morning till late at night. It was known that father and son often quarreled. It was known that Fernando maintained that the shoes, especially the women's, couldn't be made as Leela had invented them, that they were only a child's fantasy. It was known that Reno maintained the opposite, and that he went to Leela to ask her to intervene. It was known that Leela said she didn't want to know about it, and so Reno went to Stefano and dragged him to the shop to give his father specific orders. It was known that Stefano went in and looked for a long time at Leela's designs framed on the walls, smiled to himself, and said tranquilly that he wanted the shoes to be exactly as they were in those pictures. He had hung them there for that purpose. It was known, in short, that things were proceeding slowly, that the workers first received instructions from Fernando, and then Reno changed them, and everything stopped and started over, and Fernando noticed the changes and changed them back, and Stefano arrived, and so back to square one. They ended up yelling, breaking things. I glanced in and immediately fled. But the pictures hanging on the walls made an impression. Those drawings, for Leela, were fantasies, I thought. Money has nothing to do with it. Selling has nothing to do with it. All that activity is the result of a whim of hers, celebrated by Stefano merely out of love. She's lucky to be so loved, to love. Lucky to be adored for what she is and for what she invents. Now that she's given her brother what he wanted, now that she's taken him out of danger, surely she'll invent something else. So I don't want to lose sight of her. Something will happen. But nothing happened. Leela established herself in the role of Stefano's fiancée. And even in our conversations, when she had time to talk, she seemed satisfied with what she had become, as if she no longer saw anything beyond it, didn't want to see anything beyond it, except marriage, a house, children. I was disappointed. She seemed sweeter, without the hardness she had always had. I realized this later, when through Giliola Spagnuolo I heard disgraceful rumors about her. Giliola said to me rancorously, in dialect, "Now your friend is acting like a princess. But does Stefano know that when Marcella went to her house, she gave him a blowjob every night?" I didn't know what a blowjob was. The term had been familiar to me since I was a child, but the sound of it recalled only a kind of disfigurement, something very humiliating. "It's not true. Marcello says so. He's a liar." "Yes? And would he lie even to his brother?" "Did Michele tell you?" "Yes." I hoped that those rumors wouldn't reach Stefano. Every day when I came home from school, I said to myself, maybe I should warn Leela before something bad happens. But I was afraid she would be furious, and that, because of how she had grown up, because of how she was made, she would go directly to Marcello Salata with the shoemaker's knife. But in the end, I decided it was better to report to her what I had learned, so she would be prepared to confront the situation. But I discovered that she already knew about it. Not only that, she was better informed than me about what a blowjob was. I realized it from the fact that she used a clearer formulation to tell me it was so disgusting to her that she would never do it to any man, let alone Marcello Salata. Then she told me that Stefano had heard the rumor, and he had asked her what type of relations she had had with Marcello during the period when he went to the Cerullo house. She had said angrily, "None! Are you crazy?" And Stefano had said immediately that he believed her, that he had never had doubts, that he had asked the question only to let her know that Marcello was saying obscene things about her. Yet he seemed distracted, like someone who, even against his will, is following scenes of disaster that are forming in his mind. Leela had realized it, and they had discussed it for a long time. She had confessed that she, too, felt a need for revenge. But what was the use? After talk and more talk, they had decided by mutual consent to rise a step above the Salatas, above the logic of the neighborhood. "A step above?" I asked, marveling. "Yes, to ignore them. Marcello, his brother, the father, the grandfather, all of them. Act as if they didn't exist." So Stefano had continued to go to work, without defending the honor of his fiancée. Leela had continued her life as a fiancée, without resorting to the knife or anything else. The Salatas had continued to spread obscenities. I was astonished. What was happening? I didn't understand. The Salatas' behavior seemed more comprehensible. It seemed to me consistent with the world that we had known since we were children. What, instead, did she and Stefano have in mind? Where did they think they were living? They were behaving in a way that wasn't familiar, even in the poems that I studied in school, in the novels I read. I was puzzled. They weren't reacting to the insults. even to that truly intolerable insult that the Saladas were making. They displayed kindness and politeness toward everyone, as if they were John and Jacqueline Kennedy visiting a neighborhood of indigents. When they went out walking together, and he put an arm around her shoulders, it seemed that none of the old rules were valid for them. They laughed, they joked, they embraced, they kissed each other on the lips. I saw them speeding around in the convertible, alone even in the evening, always dressed like movie stars, and I thought, they go wherever they want, without a chaperone, and not secretly, but with the consent of their parents, with the consent of Reno, and do whatever they like, without caring what people say. Was it Leela who had persuaded Stefano to behave in a way that was making them the most admired and most talked about couple in the neighborhood? Was this her latest invention? Did she want to leave the neighborhood by staying in the neighborhood? Did she want to drag us out of ourselves, tear off the old skin and put on a new one, suitable for what she was inventing? 47. Everything returned abruptly to the usual track when the rumors about Leela reached Pasquale. It happened one Sunday, when Carmela, Enzo, Pasquale, Antonio, and I were walking along the Stradone. Antonio said, "I hear that Marcella Solara is telling everyone that Leela was with him." Enzo didn't blink. Pasquale immediately flared up.
"Was how?"
Antonio was embarrassed by my and Carmela's presence and said, "You understand." They moved away to talk among themselves. I saw and heard that Pasquale was increasingly enraged, that Enzo was becoming physically more compact, as if he no longer had arms, legs, neck, as if he were a block of hard material. Why is it, I wondered, that they are so angry? Leela isn't a sister of theirs or even a cousin. And yet they feel it's their duty to be indignant, all three of them, more than Stefano, much more than Stefano, as if they were the true fiancés. Pasquale especially seemed ridiculous. He, who only a short time before had said what he had said, shouted at one point, and we heard him clearly with our own ears, "I'll smash the face of that shit calling her a whore. Even if Stefano allows it, I'm not going to allow it." Then silence. They rejoined us, and we wandered aimlessly, I talking to Antonio, Carmela between her brother and Enzo. After a while, they took us home. I saw them going off, Enzo, who was the shortest, in the middle, flanked by Antonio and Pasquale. The next day, and on those which followed, there was a big uproar about the Solara's 1100. It had been demolished. Not only that, the two brothers had been savagely beaten, but they couldn't say by whom. They swore they had been attacked on a dark street by at least 10 people, men from outside the neighborhood. But Carmela and I knew very well that there were only 3 attackers, and we were worried. We waited for the inevitable reprisal. 1 day, 2, 3. But evidently things had been done right. Pasquale continued as a construction worker, Antonio as a mechanic. Enzo made his rounds with the cart. The Solaras, instead, for some time went around only on foot, battered, a little dazed, always with 4 or 5 of their friends. I admit that seeing them in that condition pleased me. I was proud of my friends. Along with Carmen and Ada, I criticized Stefano and also Reno because they had acted as if nothing had happened. Then time passed. Marcello and Michele bought a green Giulietta and began to act like masters of the neighborhood again. Alive and well. Bigger bullies than before. A sign that perhaps Leela was right. With people like that, you had to fight them by living a superior life such as they couldn't even imagine. While I was taking my exams in the second year of high school, she told me that in the spring, when she was barely 16 and a half, she would be married. 48. This news upset me. When Leela told me about her wedding, it was June, just before my oral exams. It was predictable, of course, but now that a date had been fixed, March 12th, it was as if I had been strolling absent-mindedly and banged into a door. I had petty thoughts. I counted the months. 9. Maybe 9 months was long enough so that Pinuccia's treacherous resentment, Maria's hostility, Marcello Solara's gossip, which continued to fly from mouth to mouth throughout the neighborhood, like Fama in the Aeneid, would wear Stefano down, leading him to break the engagement. I was ashamed of myself, but I was no longer able to trace a coherent design in the division of our fates. The concreteness of that date made concrete the crossroads that would separate our lives. And what was worse, I took it for granted that her fate would be better than mine. I felt more strongly than ever the meaninglessness of school. I knew clearly that I had embarked on that path years earlier, only to seem enviable to Leela. And now, instead, books had no importance for her. I stopped preparing for my exams. I didn't sleep that night. I thought of my meager experience of love. I had kissed Gino once. I had scarcely grazed Nino's lips. I had endured the fleeting and ugly contact of his father. That was it. Whereas Leela, starting in March at 16, would have a husband, and within a year at 17, a child, and then another, and another, and another. I felt I was a shadow. I wept in despair. The next day, I went unwillingly to take the exams. But something happened that made me feel better. Professor Geraci and Professor Galliani, who were part of the committee, praised my Italian paper to the skies. Geraci, in particular, said that my exposition was further improved. He wanted to read a passage to the rest of the committee. And only as I listened did I realize what I had tried to do in those months whenever I had to write. To free myself from artificial tones, from sentences that were too rigid. To try for a fluid and engaging style like Leela's in the Ischia letter. When I heard my words in the teacher's voice, with Professor Galliani listening and silently nodding agreement, I realized that I had succeeded. Naturally, it wasn't Leela's way of writing. It was mine. And it seemed to my teachers something truly out of the ordinary. I was promoted to the third year with all tens. But at home, no one was surprised or celebrated me. I saw that they were satisfied, yes, and I was pleased, but they gave the event no weight. My mother, in fact, found my scholastic success completely natural. My father told me to go right away to Maestra Oliviero to ask her to get ahead of time the books for next year. As I went out, my mother cried, "And if she wants to send you to Ischia again, tell her that I'm not well and you have to help me in the house." The teacher praised me, but carelessly, partly because by now she took my ability for granted, partly because she wasn't well. The illness she had in her mouth was very troublesome. She never mentioned my need to rest, her cousin Nella, Ischia. Instead, surprisingly, she began to talk about Leela. She had seen her on the street from a distance. She was with her fiancé, she said. The grocer. Then she added a sentence that I will always remember. The beauty of mind that Cirullo had from childhood didn't find an outlet, Greco, and it has all ended up in her face, in her breasts, in her thighs, in her ass. Places where it soon fades, and it will be as if she had never had it. I had never heard her say a rude word since I had known her. That day she said, "Ass," and then muttered, "Excuse me." But that wasn't what struck me. It was the regret, as if the teacher were realizing that something of Leela had been ruined because she, as the teacher, hadn't protected and nurtured it well. I felt that I was her most successful student and went away relieved. The only one who congratulated me without reserve was Alfonso, who had also been promoted with all sevens. I felt that his admiration was genuine, and this gave me pleasure. In front of the posted grades, in the presence of our schoolmates and their parents, he, in his excitement, did something inappropriate, as if he had forgotten that I was a girl and he wasn't supposed to touch me. He hugged me tight and kissed me on the cheek, a noisy kiss. Then he became confused, apologized, and yet he couldn't contain himself. He cried, "All tens! Impossible! All tens!" On the way home, we talked a lot about the wedding of his brother, of Leela. Since I felt especially at ease, I asked him for the first time what he thought of his future sister-in-law. He took some time before he answered. Then he said, "You remember the competitions they made us do at school? Who could forget them? I was sure I would win. You were all afraid of my father. Leela, too. In fact, for a while she tried not to beat you." "Yes, but then she decided to win, and she humiliated me. I went home crying." "It's not nice to lose." "Not because of that. It seemed to me intolerable that everyone was terrified of my father, me first of all, and that girl wasn't."
"Were you in love with her?"
"Are you kidding? She always made me uncomfortable."
"In what sense?"
"In the sense that my brother really shows some courage in marrying her."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that you are better, and that if it were me choosing, I would marry you."
This, too, pleased me.
We burst out laughing. We said goodbye, still laughing. He was condemned to spend the summer in the grocery store. I, thanks to a decision of my mother more than my father, had to find a job for the summer. We promised to meet, to go at least once to the beach together. We didn't. In the following days, I reluctantly made the rounds of the neighborhood. I asked Don Paolo, the pharmacist on the Stradone, if he needed a clerk. No. I asked the newspaper seller. I wasn't useful to him either. I went by the stationer's. She started laughing. She needed someone, yes, but not now. I should come back in the fall when school began. I was about to go, and she called me back. She said, "You're a serious girl, Lenu. I trust you. Would you be able to take my girls swimming?" I was really happy when I left the shop. The stationer would pay me, and pay well, if I took her three little girls to the beach for the month of July and the first 10 days of August. Sea, sun, and money. I was to go every day to a place between Mergellina and Posillipo that I knew nothing about. It had a foreign name, Sea Garden. I went home in great excitement, as if my life had taken a decisive turn. I would earn money for my parents. I would go swimming. I would become smooth and golden in the sun as I had during the summer in Ischia. How sweet everything is, I thought, when the day is fine and every good thing seems to be waiting for you alone. I had gone a short distance when that impression of privileged hours was solidified. Antonio joined me in his grease-stained overalls. I was pleased. Whoever I had met at that moment of happiness would have been greeted warmly. He had seen me passing and had run after me. I told him about the stationer. He must have read in my face that it was a happy moment. For months I had been grinding away, feeling alone, ugly. Although I was sure I loved Nino Saratore, I had always avoided him
and hadn't even gone to see if he had been promoted and with what grades. Leela was about to complete a definitive leap beyond my life. I would no longer be able to follow her. But now I felt good, and I wanted to feel even better. When Antonio, guessing that I was in the right mood, asked if I wanted to be his girlfriend, I said yes right away, even though I loved someone else, even if I felt for him nothing but some friendliness. To have him as a boyfriend, he, who was an adult, the same age as Stefano, a worker, seemed to me a thing not different from being promoted with all tens, from the job of taking, with pay, the daughters of the stationer to the sea garden. 49. My job began, and life with a boyfriend. The stationer gave me a sort of bus pass, and every morning I crossed the city with the three little girls on the crowded buses and took them to that bright-colored place of beach umbrellas, blue sea, concrete platforms, students, well-off women with a lot of free time, showy women with greedy faces. I was polite to the attendants who tried to start conversations. I looked after the children, taking them for long swims, and showing off the bathing suit that Nella had made for me the year before. I fed them, played with them, let them drink endlessly at the jet of a stone fountain, taking care that they didn't slip and break their teeth on the basin. We got back to the neighborhood in the late afternoon. I returned the children to the stationer and hurried to my secret date with Antonio, burned by the sun, salty from the seawater. We went to the ponds by back streets. I was afraid of being seen by my mother, and perhaps, still more, by Maestra Oliviero. With him, I exchanged my first real kisses. I soon let him touch my breasts and between my legs. One evening, I touched his penis, straining, large, inside his pants. And when he took it out, I held it willingly in one hand while we kissed. I accepted those practices with two very clear questions in my mind. The first was, does Leela do these things with Stefano? The second was, is the pleasure I feel with Antonio the same that I felt the night Donato Sartori touched me? In both cases, Antonio was ultimately only a useful phantom to evoke, on the one hand, the love between Leela and Stefano. On the other, the strong emotion, difficult to categorize, that Nino's father had inspired in me. But I never felt guilty. Antonio was so grateful to me. He showed such an absolute dependence on me for those few moments of contact at the ponds, that I soon convinced myself that it was he who was indebted to me, that the pleasure I gave him was by far superior to that which he gave me. Sometimes, on Sunday, he went with me and the children to the sea garden. He spent money with pretended casualness, though he earned very little, and he also hated getting sunburned. But he did it for me, just to be near me, without any immediate reward, since there was no way to kiss or touch each other. And he entertained the children with clowning and athletic diving. While he played with them, I lay in the sun reading, dissolving into the pages like a jellyfish. One of those times, I looked up for a second and saw a tall, slender, graceful girl in a stunning red bikini. It was Leela. By now she was used to having men's gaze on her. She moved as if there were no one in that crowded place, not even the young attendant who went ahead of her, leading her to her umbrella. She didn't see me, and I didn't know whether to call her. She was wearing sunglasses. She carried a purse of bright-colored fabric. I hadn't yet told her about my job, or even about Antonio. Probably I was afraid of her judgment of both. Let's wait for her to notice me, I thought, and turned back to my book. But I was unable to read. Soon I looked in her direction again. The attendant had opened the chaise. She was sitting in the sun. Meanwhile, Stefano was arriving, very white, in a blue bathing suit. In his hand, his wallet, lighter, cigarettes. He kissed Leela on the lips, the way princes kiss sleeping beauties, and also sat down on a chaise. Again, I tried to read. I had long been used to self-discipline, and this time, for a few minutes, I really did manage to grasp the meaning of the words. I remember that the novel was Oblomov. When I looked up again, Stefano was still sitting, staring at the sea. Leela had disappeared. I searched for her and saw that she was talking to Antonio, and Antonio was pointing to me. I gave her a warm wave, to which she responded as warmly, and she turned to call Stefano. We went swimming, the three of us, while Antonio watched the stationer's daughters. It was a day of seeming cheerfulness. At one point, Stefano took us to the bar, ordered all kinds of things, sandwiches, drinks, ice cream, and the children immediately abandoned Antonio and turned their attention to him. When the two young men began to talk about some problems with the convertible, a conversation in which Antonio had a lot to say, I took the little girls away so that they wouldn't bother them. Leela joined me. How much does the stationer pay you? She asked. I told her. Not much. My mother thinks she pays me too much. You should assert yourself, Lenu. I'll assert myself when I take your children to the beach. I'll give you treasure chests full of gold pieces. I know the value of spending time with you. I looked at her to see if she was joking. She wasn't joking, but she joked right afterward when she mentioned Antonio. Does he know your value? We've been together for 3 weeks. Do you love him? No. So? I challenged her with a look. Do you love Stefano? She said seriously, very much. More than your parents? More than Reno? More than everyone, but not more than you. You're making fun of me. But meanwhile, I thought, even if she's kidding, it's nice to talk like this, in the sun, sitting on the warm concrete, with our feet in the water. Never mind if she didn't ask what book I'm reading. Never mind if she didn't find out how the exams went. Maybe it's not all over. Even after she's married, something between us will endure. I said to her, I come here every day. Why don't you come too? She was enthusiastic about the idea. She spoke to Stefano about it, and he agreed. It was a beautiful day on which all of us miraculously felt at our ease. Then the sun began to go down. It was time to take the children home. Stefano went to pay, and discovered that Antonio had taken care of everything. He was really sorry. He thanked him wholeheartedly. On the street, as soon as Stefano and Leela went off in the convertible, I reproached him. Melina and Ada washed the stairs of the buildings. He earned practically nothing in the garage. Why did you pay? I almost yelled at him, in dialect, angrily. Because you and I are better looking and more refined, he answered. 50. I grew fond of Antonio almost without realizing it. Our sexual games became a little bolder, a little more pleasurable. I thought that if Leela came again to the sea garden, I would ask her what happened between her and Stefano when they went off in the car alone. Did they do the same things that Antonio and I did, or more? For example, the things that the rumors started by the two Solaras said she did? I had no one to compare myself with except her. But there was no chance to ask her those questions. She didn't come back to the sea garden. In mid-August, my job was over, and with it, the joy of sun and sea. The stationer was extremely satisfied with the way I had taken care of the children, and although they, in spite of my instructions, had told their mother that sometimes a young man who was my friend came to the beach, with whom they did some lovely dives, instead of reproaching me, embraced me, saying, "Thank goodness. Let go a little, please. You're too sensible for your age." And she added maliciously, "Think of Lena Cerullo, all she gets up to." At the ponds that evening, I said to Antonio, "It's always been like that, since we were little. Everyone thinks she's bad and I'm good." He kissed me, murmuring ironically, "Why, isn't that true?" That response touched me and kept me from telling him that we had to part. It was a decision that seemed to me urgent. The affection wasn't love. I loved Nino. I knew I would love him forever. I had a gentle speech prepared for Antonio. I wanted to say to him, "It's been wonderful. You helped me a lot at a time when I was sad. But now school is starting, and this year is going to be difficult. I have new subjects. I'll have to study a lot. I'm sorry, but we have to stop." I felt it was necessary, and every afternoon I went to our meeting at the ponds with my little speech ready. But he was so affectionate, so passionate, that my courage failed and I put it off. In the middle of August, by the end of the month, I said, "You can't kiss, touch a person and be touched, and be only a little fond of him. Lila loves Stefano very much. I did not love Antonio." The time passed, and I could never find the right moment to speak to him. I was worried. In the heat, Melina generally got worse, but in the second half of August, the deterioration became very noticeable. Saratore returned to her mind, whom she called Donato. She said she had seen him. She said he had come to get her. Her children didn't know how to soothe her. I became anxious that Saratore really had appeared on the streets of the neighborhood, and that he was looking not for Melina, but for me. At night, I woke with a start, under the impression that he had come in through the window and was in the room. Then I calmed down. I thought, he must be on vacation in Barano, at the Meronti, not here, in this heat, with the flies, the dust. But one morning when I was going to do the shopping, I heard my name called. I turned, and at first I didn't recognize him. Then I brought into focus the black mustache, the pleasing features gilded by the sun, the thin-lipped mouth. I kept going. He followed me. He said that he had been pained not to find me at Nella's house in Burano that summer. He said that he thought only of me, that he couldn't live without me. He said that to give a form to our love, he had written many poems and would like to read them to me. He said that he wanted to see me, talk to me at leisure, that if I refused, he would kill himself. Then I stopped and whispered that he had to leave me alone. I had a boyfriend. I never wanted to see him again. He despaired. He murmured that he would wait for me forever, that every day at noon he would be at the entrance to the tunnel on the Stradone. I shook my head forcefully. I would never go there. He leaned forward to kiss me. I jumped back with a gesture of disgust. He gave a disappointed smile. He murmured, "You're clever. You're sensitive. I'll bring you the poems I like best." And he went off. I was very frightened. I didn't know what to do. I decided to turn to Antonio. That evening, at the ponds, I told him that his mother was right. Donato Saratore was wandering around the neighborhood. He had stopped me in the street. He had asked me to tell Melina that he would wait for her, always, every day, at the entrance to the tunnel, at midday. Antonio turned somber. He said, "What should I do?" I told him that I would go with him to the appointment, and that together we would give Saratore a candid speech about the state of his mother's health. I was too worried to sleep that night. The next day we went to the tunnel. Antonio was silent. He seemed in no hurry. I felt he had a weight on him that was slowing him down. One part of him was furious, and the other subdued. I thought angrily. He was capable of confronting the Solaras for his sister Ada, for Leela, but now he's intimidated. In his eyes, Donato Saratore is an important person, of a certain standing. To feel him like that made me more determined. I would have liked to shake him, shout at him, "You haven't written a book, but you are much better than that man." I merely took his arm. When Saratore saw us from a distance, he tried to disappear quickly into the darkness of the tunnel. I called him, "Signor Saratore." He turned reluctantly. Using the formal lei, something that at the time was unusual in our world, I said, "I don't know if you remember Antonio. He is the oldest son of Signora Melina." Saratore pulled out a bright, very affectionate voice. "Of course I remember him. Hello, Antonio." "He and I are together."
"Ah, good.
And we've talked a lot. Now he'll explain to you." Antonio understood that his moment had arrived, and, extremely pale and tense, he said, struggling to speak in Italian,
"I am very pleased to see you, Signor Saratore. I haven't forgotten. I will always be grateful for what you did for us after the death of my father. I thank you in particular for having found me a job in Signor Goresio's shop. I owe it to you if I have learned a trade."
"Tell him about your mother," I pressed him nervously. He was annoyed and gestured at me to be quiet. He continued,
"However, you no longer live in the neighborhood, and you don't understand the situation. My mother, if she merely hears your name, loses her head. And if she sees you, even one single time, she'll end up in the insane asylum."
Saratore gasped.
"Antonio, my boy, I never had any intention of doing harm to your mother. You justly recall how much I did for you. And in fact, I have always and only wanted to help her and all of you."
"Then if you wish to continue to help her, don't look for her. Don't send her books. Don't show up in the neighborhood."
"This you cannot ask of me. You cannot keep me from seeing again the places that are dear to me,"
Saratore said in a warm, falsely emotional voice. That tone made me indignant. I knew it. He had used it often at Barano, on the beach at the Moronti. It was rich, caressing, the tone that he imagined a man of depth who wrote poems and articles in Roma should have. I was on the point of intervening, but Antonio, to my surprise, was ahead of me. He curved his shoulders, drew in his head, and extended one hand toward the chest of Donato Saratore, pressing it with his powerful fingers. He said in dialect,
"I won't hinder you. But I promise you that if you take away my mother the little reason that she still has, you will lose forever the desire to see these shitty places again."
Saratore turned very pale.
"Yes,"
he said quickly.
"I understand. Thank you."
He turned on his heels and hurried off toward the station. I slipped in under Antonio's arm, proud of that burst of anger, but I realized that he was trembling. I thought, perhaps for the first time, of what the death of his father must have been for him as a boy, and then the job, the responsibility that had fallen on him, the collapse of his mother. I drew him away, full of affection, and gave myself another deadline. I'll leave him after Leela's wedding. 51. The neighborhood remembered that wedding for a long time. Its preparations were tangled up with the slow, elaborate, rancorous birth of Cerullo Shoes. Two undertakings that, for one reason or another, it seemed, would never come to fruition. The wedding put a strain on the shoemaker's shop. Fernando and Dorino labored not only on the new shoes, which for the moment brought in nothing, but also on a thousand other little jobs that provided immediate income, which they needed urgently. They had to put together enough money to provide Lila with a small dowry, and to meet the expenses of the refreshments, which they intended to take on, no matter what, in order not to seem like poor relations. As a result, the Cirullo household was extremely tense for months. Nunzia embroidered sheets night and day, and Fernando made constant scenes, pining for the happy days when, in the tiny shop where he was king, he glued, sewed, and hammered in peace with the tacks between his lips. The only ones who seemed unruffled were the engaged couple. There were just two small moments of friction between them. The first had to do with their future home. Stefano wanted to buy a small apartment in the new neighborhood. Lila would have preferred to live in the old buildings. They argued. The apartment in the old neighborhood was larger, but dark and had no view, like all the apartments there. The apartment in the new neighborhood was smaller, but had an enormous bathtub, like the ones in the Palmolive ad, a bidet, and a view of Vesuvius. It was useless to point out that, while Vesuvius was a shifting and distant outline that faded into the cloudy sky, less than 200 yards away ran the gleaming tracks of the railroad. Stefano was seduced by the new, by the shiny floors, by the white walls, and Lila soon gave in. What counted more than anything else was that, not yet 17, she would be the mistress of a house of her own, with hot water that came from the taps, and a house not rented, but owned. The second cause of friction was the honeymoon. Stefano proposed Venice, and Lila, revealing a tendency that would mark her whole life, insisted on not going far from Naples. She suggested a stay on Ischia, Capri, and maybe the Amalfi Coast, all places she had never been.